Right. So rheology is looking at the flow and deformation of soft materials. And the question you ask is if I perturb a system mechanically, how does it respond? So you know that a solid will respond elastically. It will deform a little bit. And if you take the stress off, it'll bounce back. And we have Hooke's law, which says that the stress is proportional to the strain. And the constant of proportionality is the elastic modulus. Okay? On the other hand, if you have a fluid, if you put a stress on it, it'll flow. And then we have Newton's law, which says that the stress is proportional to the rate of strain, not the strain. And the constant here is the viscosity. Okay? And in this case, the deformation is irreversible. If your fluid flows and you take the stress off, it doesn't come back. Now, most materials are somewhere in between. Okay, they're partly viscous, partly elastic, and so they're called viscoelastic. And in that case, the stress is going to be a function of both the strain and the strain rate, and it can be quite a complicated dependence. Okay? And so you have both an elastic modulus, which is called G primed, and a viscous modulus, which is called G double primed, and which is related to the viscosity like this. A couple of talks ago, we saw susceptibility that had a chi primed and a chi double primed, and it's exactly the same sort of thing, except we're talking about mechanical response rather than electronic response. And in general, both of these quantities are functions of the shear rate, the strain rate. The other complication I want to bring in here is that the materials I'm interested in have what's called a yield stress, which means that if you deform them, or if you apply a small shear stress, a small force to them, they'll respond elastically. But if you apply a large enough force, then they'll flow. So they're solid-like for a low applied stress, and then they flow for a large stress. Okay? So there are many examples of this. You can look in your fridge and find margarine, for example, which is solid-like until you put your knife through it. Okay? Or ice cream, or mustard. Or you can look in the bathroom and find shaving foam or hair gel or things like that. These are all fluids or materials that have a yield stress. And you might have heard of a Bingham fluid, in which case it's a model for a yield stress fluid where the stress is it's a constant, which is the yield stress, and then there's a term proportional to the strain rate, which is the viscous part. Okay? So why do materials have these complicated properties? Why are they viscoelastic? And the answer is because they have structure on the microscopic scale, on a larger scale than atoms, but on a smaller scale than the bulk. Okay? And it's this, this sort of mesoscale structure that gives complex fluids their interesting properties. Okay? So for example, if you had a solution, a concentrated solution of polymers, the polymer molecules entangle with each other. And that gives it a sort of an elasticity. And there's structure in there on the length scale of the entanglements between the polymer molecules. Or if you had a suspension of particles, then you have structure involving the ordering of the particles or the interactions between the particles. So there's structure on the length scale of the interparticle spacing. Okay? And it's this intermediate scale structure that's interesting and gives you these properties. So the interest in doing rheology on these materials is because from the way the material responds mechanically, you can learn something about this internal structure and about the internal dynamics. And of course, if you're an engineer or if you're writing a grant application, then the next thing you say is that this would allow you to design materials from the bottom up, you know, to get certain properties. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the techniques, and then I want to talk about, if I have time, I want to talk about two systems that we've studied where we use the technique of what's called microrheology to look at some of this small-scale structure. So this is an instrument called a rheometer, and it's very simple in principle. You take a sample, put it between a couple of plates, and you rotate one of them, and you measure the torque on the other one. Okay, so viscoelastic behavior of the fluid transmits the stress across the sample and gives you a torque on one of the plates. And so you can measure the elastic and the viscous modulus from the in-phase and out-of-phase components of the response to a sinusoidal perturbation. So this is a classical technique, and you can buy these off the shelf, and that's fine. The more interesting thing, which is newer, is microrheology. And these are techniques that have been developed in the last 15 years or so to measure rheological behavior, so measure viscoelastic behavior on a small scale based on the response of tracer particles to thermal fluctuations. Okay? So this is just a simulation of a particle doing a random walk undergoing Brownian motion. Okay? So if you put a little particle in a Newtonian fluid and you let it diffuse, you find that the mean squared displacement of the particle is proportional to time, and the constant of proportionality has the dimensionality of the system, small d, but it also has this diffusion constant, big D. And since we're at the Perimeter Institute, we have to mention Einstein. So this is the Stokes-Einstein relation, which relates the diffusion constant to the viscosity of the fluid, eta. Okay, and this is a consequence of the fluctuation dissipation theorem. So basically, from measuring the mean squared displacement of this particle as it undergoes diffusion, you can get the viscosity. Okay? Now, in a non-Newtonian fluid, in a complex fluid, you don't just have a viscosity, you also have an elasticity. So you can generalize the derivation of the Stokes-Einstein relation to the case where you have a viscoelasticity with a frequency-dependent viscous and elastic modulus. And if you're interested, here's a little bit of the math. But basically, by measuring the mean squared displacement of a particle diffusing, you can get the elastic modulus and the viscous modulus on the length scale that's probed by the particle doing its random walk. Okay? So your rheometer, the machine that I showed previously, measures things on scales of the size of the sample, which is millimeters or so. And studying the diffusion of particles in a fluid can give you rheology on the length scale of a micron. So if the particle you're following is large compared to the structural length scale in the material, you're essentially going to average over the structure, and you're going to get an answer that's the same as the bulk answer. Okay? And people do that, and that's fine. And there are times when this is nice to be able to do. If your material is very expensive or something like that, you can only work with small quantities. But more interesting to me is the case where your particle is smaller than the structural length scale. And then each individual particle sees a different mechanical environment and will measure the local rheological properties of the material rather than the bulk. Okay? And it turns out, and I'll show you some of this, that the local rheological properties can be very different from the bulk rheological properties because of the structure of the material. Okay? And particularly in the case that we're going to look at, the material is heterogeneous on the microscopic scale. So some parts are more elastic than others. So how do you do microrheology? There are several ways, but this is what we do, and it's probably the simplest. You put little micron-sized tracer particles in the material. You look at them with a fluorescence microscope, and you take pictures of them, and you follow their trajectory. Okay, so here's a picture. The tracer particles are these bright things. You take many pictures over a period of time, and you use a software package that is freely available on the internet to analyze the images, to isolate the particles, and to link them up from one frame to the other to get trajectories. And so, wrong button, there you go. And you can get trajectories like this, where you follow individual particles for a long time and get their trajectories, and then you can calculate the mean squared displacement. And you can take pictures with 50 particles in your field of view and track all of them simultaneously and average. So now I want to talk about some experiments we did on a material called laffanite. Laffanite is a synthetic clay, and it consists of little nanometer-sized pancakes. They're about 30 nanometers across and 1 nanometer thick. And laffanite undergoes a gel transition as a function of time. You mix it up in your beaker and you leave it to sit for a period of time depending on the concentration, but 20 minutes or an hour or something like that. And it changes from something that's obviously a liquid to something that's obviously not. It changes into a gel. Okay? And what we did is we used these microrheological technique to look at what was happening on the micron scale as the material underwent a gel transition. So these are experimental details, which you probably don't care about. What kind of length scale? In the simplest case, it's basically the length scale of the particle, which is, in this case, half a micron. You can do correlations between individual particles to study it as a function of length up to the size of your field of view, but you need a lot more data to do that, and we haven't got anything worth talking about from that yet. But other people have. Okay. So let me just tell you a little bit about the gel transition. It's a percolation transition, which means that at the gel point, the particles aggregate to form a cluster which spans the system. Before the gel transition, we're in a fluid state or a sol state, in which case the viscous modulus is bigger than the elastic modulus. It's dominated by the fluid-like behavior. And the elastic modulus goes to zero at zero frequency. After the transition, it's solid, which means the elastic modulus is bigger than the viscous modulus, and the viscosity goes to infinity. And at the gel point, these two moduli are the same, and they both show power law behavior as a function of frequency with the same exponent. Okay, so we're going to use that to identify the gel transition. So here's a plot of the viscous and elastic moduli. The red one is the elastic modulus. The blue one is the viscous modulus that we get from the bulk measurements for this Lapinite suspension as a function of time. Okay, so we mix up the sample at time zero, and then we just measure it as time passes. It starts off being fluid with the viscous modulus higher. It ends up being solid with the elastic modulus higher. And there's a crossover around 1,000 seconds where the moduli are equal. So on the bulk scale, we have a gel transition at around 1,000 seconds. This is the yield stress that we measured for this. And it appears somewhere around a few hundred or 1,000 seconds, but it's clear that it keeps growing way after the gel transition. Okay, we saw a gel transition at 1,000 seconds, and our yield stress is continuing to increase. So the properties of the material continue to change well after the gel transition at 1,000 seconds. That's what I just said. Okay. So here are some pictures of particle trajectories that we got from the microrheological measurements. At early times, the particle moves relatively freely. But at later times, it gets more and more confined until that's a long time. It's essentially completely immobilized. Okay, so obviously, things change on the microscopic scale, too. It starts off being almost diffusive, and it ends up being trapped. This is the mean squared displacement of the particles as a function of time. As a function of time. So the red circles up here are the earliest time, about half an hour after we started the experiment. And we go down to 72,000 seconds, which is 10 hours or something like that. Okay? And you can see it starts off. I'll show you in a second. This is the slope pretty close to 1, but the slope gets lower and lower as time goes on, and the mean squared displacement gets less and less. So we can take the slope of these lines over a period, and we can plot the slope as a function of the age of the sample. And you can see that it starts off near 1, which is what you'd expect for normal diffusion, but the slope decreases as the sample gets older, and somewhere around 5,000 seconds or so, the particles essentially stop moving, and the slope is pretty much zero. Okay? Yeah? It's the clay particles are aggregating. They interact electrostatically, and so they're clumping together, basically. Okay? Okay, so somewhere around 5,000 seconds, the particles become immobilized. And this is much later than the bulk gel point that we measured. Okay, so it's clear that the particles can still move around on the micron scale, even though on a bulk scale, it's a gel. So here are the viscous and elastic moduli that we get from the mean squared displacement data. So these are the viscous and elastic moduli on the micron scale. Okay, and you can see that at early times, it's fluid-like on the micron scale. The viscous modulus is bigger than the elastic modulus. And at late times, it's a solid, with the elastic modulus being bigger. And somewhere in here, around 3,600 seconds, probably a little bit before that, the two moduli are equal, and that looks like the gel transition. Okay? You can imagine that a couple of hundred seconds before this, they would fall right on top of each other. Okay, so we have a gel transition on the micron scale at around 3,600 seconds. Okay, so we have a different gel time on the bulk scale that we do on the micron scale. So here's a plot. This is the same data I showed before for the bulk of viscous and elastic moduli. And here is the viscous and elastic moduli measured on the micron scale. And you can see that they're totally different. And in particular, you can see that they both show a transition. They both have a crossover, but at very different times. So on the millimeter scale, from the bulk rheometry, we get a gel transition at around 1,000 seconds. On the scale of the particles, we get a transition at around 3,600 seconds. And then I also showed earlier that the particles become essentially immobilized at about 5,000 seconds. And this corresponds to basically the minimum detectable displacement of the particles. And so that's a length scale of about 20 nanometers. Okay, so then I can plot this graph, which I think is really beautiful. The error bars on here are probably huge, but the fact is that we see the time of the gel transition gets, I should start at this end. The time of the gel transition gets later and later as we go to a smaller and smaller length scale. Okay? So what's going on? The gel transition on the bulk occurs when the particles aggregate through these electrostatic interactions to form a percolation cluster. Okay? And even though you have a macroscopic cluster that spans the sample and gives it rigidity on the bulk scale, there are still lots of holes, right? So all of the white regions in this little simulation, or sorry, all of the black regions in this simulation are voids, which you can think of as being liquid containing unaggregated clay particles, so it's just the original material that hasn't gelled yet. So there are these voids on all length scales, even though we have a gel on the bulk scale. So the particles that are diffusing around in these so-called voids still see a fluid region. Okay, and as time passes, the clay particles that are in these voids eventually organize themselves and join the aggregates, and the voids get smaller and smaller, and so as the aggregation continues, the clay particles in these voids join the cluster, become part of the gel, and so we proceed on a downwards in length scale as the gelation proceeds. We form a big cluster that spans the sample, and then we get rid of the small parts after that. So essentially, we see that it looks like the gelation proceeds downwards in length scale as time passes. Okay, how am I doing for time? 5 minutes. Okay, I'll talk fast. So the other system I want to talk about is a rather different system. It's called Carbopol. This is a polymer microgel system. It's essentially the stuff you put in hair gel. Okay, so it consists of sort of micron-sized polymer particles. These are made up of cross-linked polymer molecules to make little particles about a micron in size. When you put them in water and neutralize the pH, the molecules become charged and they repel each other and stretch out, so these things expand. Okay, and when they bump into each other, they develop a yield stress and form a gel. So you can imagine a room full of half-inflated beach balls or something like that, and they're going to just sterically interact with each other and make a gel. And we looked at the microrheology in this stuff as a function of the concentration of these microgel particles to try and see what the structure of this material was on the micron scale. So again, we measured, we tracked the particles, measured the mean squared displacement. This time, I'm plotting these for different concentrations of these microgel particles. So So low concentration up here, essentially a Newtonian fluid. The slope of this is 1, which is what you get for normal diffusion. And as we increase the concentration, the slope gets smaller and the displacement gets smaller. This graph up here shows the logarithmic slope, which is called alpha. So this is the slope of these curves again. It's 1 for low concentrations, and it starts to get smaller. This is, however, we're averaging all of the particles. And we can learn something about the local variations in the rheology by looking at the squared displacement of each individual particle, fitting that to a power law, and looking at the distribution of the logarithmic slopes of the squared displacements for each individual particle. So the plots up here are histograms showing the different values of this alpha for different concentrations. So at a low concentration, there's essentially one peak. It's sort of broad, but there's one peak, which peaks somewhere around 1, which is what you'd expect for diffusion. As you increase the concentration, you start to get 2 peaks. So here, there's quite clearly 2 populations, right? There's one population that has alpha around 1, so it's diffusing more or less freely. There's another population where the motion is much more restricted, and it's moving more slowly. So this is, we call this the fast population, and this is the slow population. And then at higher concentrations, this is quite a bit higher, the slope is essentially 0 for all the particles, and they're essentially trapped. Okay. So this is a plot of this exponent, the power law exponent on the squared displacement. So this is alpha as a function of concentration. This is another graph that I think is really lovely. The fast population has alpha equals 1, independent of concentration. So it's always diffusing freely. The slow population appears somewhere around a concentration of 0.1, and alpha decreases. If you look at how many of the tracer particles are in the slow population, starts out being 0. And as it starts to appear around 0.1, the number of particles in the slow concentration increases until eventually they're all in the slow population. This is the mean squared displacement of the fast population here and the slow population here. So we've separated it into 2 groups, fast and slow. And you can see that the mobility of each population doesn't really change as a function of concentration. Each different color here is a different concentration. So the fast population doesn't care what the concentration is. It's seeing the same environment as a function of concentration. Similarly, there's some noise here, but the slow population, its behavior doesn't change as a function of concentration. When I first saw this, I thought we must have a first-order phase transition where we have coexisting phases where the properties don't change. But that turned out to be wrong. But basically, even though the concentration is changing, the tracer particles are seeing a similar environment as a function of concentration. This shows the rheological parameters. Let's see, the red is bulk measurements. The blue is the slow population. And the green is the fast population. And again, the bulk behavior is rather different from the microscopic behavior. Okay. The yield stress here appears at a concentration of about 0.04 or something and grows as the concentration increases. So since I'm short on time, I'll just quickly explain what's going on here. These microgels expand in the solution. And it turns out they expand an awful lot. We have some other measurements that show that they're about 36 microns in diameter when they've expanded, which is about 20 times bigger than they are when they're dry. And so they're essentially nothing, right? They're very open. And in fact, the particles, I think, can actually diffuse right through them without seeing them. Okay? So the fast population is essentially diffusing around inside through these particles without seeing them, essentially. When these microgel particles bump into each other, we start to develop a yield stress. And tracers that get trapped where the microgels are in contact are affected by these polymer molecules hanging around. And so their motion is very restricted. And this is the slow population. Okay? As we increase the concentration, the microgels get more and more mushed together, and so their contact regions are bigger and bigger, so more and more of the particles are trapped there. But the physical properties of the regions where they mush together don't change very much. Okay? And then essentially, as you go to higher and higher concentrations, eventually the microgels get squished enough that there's no room for the particles to diffuse anywhere, and they all get trapped. And the picture we got of this by doing the microrheology, and I haven't been able to give you all of the details, but we get a very, in my sense, very vivid picture of what's going on the microscopic scale by looking at how these particles move. So I'll just summarize by making some very general conclusions. One is that we can use microrheology to look at the structure of these complex fluids on sort of micron length scales. And the behavior of these materials on the bulk scale and the micron scale can be very different. Thank you. Oh, one more thing. This is the guy who did all the work. Michel.
You mentioned that this gelation transition is like a percolation transition.
Yeah.
And so I'm wondering, can you actually, there's all sorts of critical properties of percolating clusters, you know, and scaling indices and so on and so on. Can you actually attack this problem with your thing and show that really, the probability that a particle belongs to a percolating cluster is obeys what you would expect based on percolation in a continuum, and is that of any interest?
I think it would be interesting, and I think we can do it. We haven't gone very far yet. I mean, you can see, if I zip back here, I mean, you could imagine getting critical exponents from graphs like this, right? You'd have to have better time resolution than we did to get it at the actual gel point. So you can imagine getting critical exponents. I think there are, I don't think the critical exponents in the percolation, in the gel transition that people have measured are universal in the sense that every material has the same exponent. But I think we could certainly measure exponents and compare them with what you get on the bulk scale. Yeah, I agree. But I mean, people have measured gel transitions in different systems, polymers and things like that, and they don't all have the same critical exponents. So I'm not quite sure what that means. But I think this is probably not the best system to do a study like that in. I think it would be better to do something as a function of temperature where you don't have to worry about waiting times and so on. But I'd like to do that. Yeah.
So two things. First, related to this, a lot of people do this. They look at this when G prime equals G double prime and say that's the gel transition. But in terms of like the theoretical definition that it's the first infinite cluster, those are not the same. That would be basically where it first supports static shear. So how are those things actually related?
So that's saying that G prime equals G double prime is a sloppy definition of the gel transition. The real definition is when both have the same power law dependence on frequency.
Oh, okay,
so when
okay.
you see the critical phenomenon, right. that's when you're at the critical point.
And the other thing, when you had those, the motion of the particle and the kind of random motion, presumably this isn't actually random motion because it should still have two-step relaxation, right? So if you actually took a particle autocorrelation function, you would actually see two steps and then you would, I mean, could you treat this like a glass transition and kind of what people do for mode coupling and get this divergence of this other relaxation time?
I'd have to sit down with you over lunch and parse the question better. But it's not purely random motion.
Right, you can tell in that first one.
Right?
It's cage. Like there's two length scales for the motion, right? Oops, there's the cage, and then there's diffusion out of the cage.
Yes.
Yeah, right. So this is right there.
I mean, here it's trapped here in some sort of a cage, and then it wanders off, right?
Right.
So we've done some work where we've looked in some more detail at this caging sort of behavior. And you can get sort of the characteristic length scale of the cages and things like that.
Right.
Yeah. In terms of relaxation times, I'd have to think about it a bit more. But you can certainly get a lot of information about this sort of caging behavior.
It's a bit different, I guess, because when people do it in glass formers, all those systems are in equilibrium. So you have a long time to wait.
Yeah.
You don't have
so again, this is probably not the best system to look at that sort of behavior, but it can be done. Yeah. Rachel.
This is just a naive question. So when you talked about the percolation idea, are there really just two length scales? Like if at a sort of at a single time scale for the overall gelation process, and you look at particles at different positions, are sort of one subset of them moving in one way and the other subset moving in a different way, or is there a whole continuum of different ways in which they're moving?
There's certainly a whole continuum of length scales, right? I mean, at the gel transition, the percolation cluster's a fractal, and the voids have a power law distribution of sizes. So there's no characteristic length scale at the transition. I think the key is that the particles are moving sort of microns. So anything that's bigger than a micron is infinite. So if you have voids that are 10 microns or 5 microns or whatever, it doesn't matter. They're still going to see them as essentially as fluids that they can diffuse freely in. I think in the ideal case, there's two mobilities, but there's going to be some variation. I mean, let's see. I mean, the void-like regions, they're water with suspended clay particles in them, and presumably that's the same material in all of the voids, right? And the percolation cluster is some sort of aggregate of clay particles, and presumably its properties are more or less uniform throughout. So I would certainly expect to see two populations, although the populations might be a little bit smeared out. But I wouldn't expect to see a continuum smear. I'd expect to see two populations.